from KQED.
This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Climate change is also having its impact here in the Bay Area, and SPUR, the San Francisco Planning and Urban Research Association, has released a study called Climate Change Hits Home, which emphasizes recommended local strategies for combating climate change. And joining us in this segment to discuss the SPUR report and its strategies and recommendations are the lead writer of the report. There was a whole task force, including our former intern Egon, who got involved in this, Sustainable Development Policy Director of SPUR, San Francisco Planning and Urban Research Association, Laura Tam, here in studio. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. Will Travis is also with us, Executive Director of the San Francisco Bay Conservation and Development Commission, the BCDC. It's a state agency responsible for protecting the San Francisco Bay, and he's on SPUR's board. He chaired the task force that helped prepare the report. Will Travis, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Michael.
Morning to you. Let me begin, Laura Tam, with you. What prompted this?
Well, we've been working for a very long time to try to stop global warming, but our efforts have not been very successful at the global level. We have been demonstrating great leadership in California and in the Bay Area to try to slow down climate change through, especially at SPUR, through trying to promote transit-oriented development in communities where people can walk and bike instead of taking their cars. And cities around the region are developing climate action plans. However, I think we have to acknowledge now that some climate change we're already committed to, and it's going to happen, and those impacts will affect the Bay Area, and it's time to start preparing for those impacts.
Well, you've got some strategies here about mitigation and about local adaptations. I mean, you've pretty well outlined at least things that can be done.
That's true. I think we tried to take an approach that is very actionable, and we sort of outline the main threats of climate change to the region, which include extreme heat, potentially a lack of rainfall in places where we need to capture it for water supply, and an overload of it in urban areas where we don't want it to flood our streets, and then of course sea level rise, which is
we were just talking about, as you know, in the last half hour.
Yeah, it's a confounding issue. No one really knows how to plan for it, but we hope with this report we're showing local governments some opportunities for how to start.
There's no strategy now, really, is there? I mean, you've got a plan of action here, but in terms of what local government is doing specifically for the kind of things that we're anticipating and the kind of things that are in the future, perhaps?
There's a lot of information that's been put together by the state, and many reports have come out recently that have said how bad sea level rise could be and what the impacts might be on the region, both in the Bay and on the ocean coastline. But there is no coherent strategy for the region, and that's something that we recommend.
People think AB 32 sort of moves us towards strategy, and in some ways, of course, it does. I'm talking about state level, but you're talking about really changing the whole nature in some respects of the infrastructure to respond to this.
Yeah, AB 32 is a very important law, and what it will do is reduce emissions from, you know, the ways that we drive and the ways that we grow and how we, in the industry and the economy of the state. It's a very important law, and, you know, the fact that we have to prepare for the impacts of climate change should not be an indicator that we should stop trying to fight global warming through implementing AB 32. But this is kind of going in a different direction and saying we need to prepare for these impacts in spite of the fact that we have good laws in place in California to try to do our part to solve global warming.
Again, Laura Tam here with us in studios, Sustainable Development Policy Director for SPUR and the lead writer of a report that SPUR has put out. And by the way, people can get that report online, can they not?
Yeah, that's right, at our website, spur.org/adaptation.
And Will Travis, also with us this morning, Executive Director of the San Francisco Bay Conservation and Development Commission and on the board of SPUR. And how do we know, really, about these predictions? You know, you can always hear the naysayers raising that question. What can you tell them along those lines, Will?
Well, the scientists are by nature skeptical, and they never come to complete agreement. But there is a great deal of scientific consensus that over the next 50 years, we're going to be facing at least 12 to 19 inches of sea level rise. And there are a whole host of other impacts. I think the question there is, the issue there is not so much the science, but the reticence to do anything about it right now. Local governments are strapped for money. They're trying to avoid laying off firefighters and cops. They want to make sure they're hiring the teachers in the fall. And they look forward 50 years and say, well, we've got time to deal with this. The challenge is for all of us is taking what will become a crisis in the future if we don't deal with it now and dragging it back into the present and taking steps now. And I think the SPUR report really highlights this problem for local governments in the Bay Area.
Well, with all the financial challenges that you've alluded to and the challenge that's up ahead in light of the Spur report, what are you recommending residents and specifically agencies ought to be doing?
Well, we all need to engage in this together, and I think one of the things that is so important coming out of the Spur report is Spur is fundamentally a business organization. It's a public policy think tank, but it's largely supported by businesses. And up until now, climate change has been seen largely as an environmental issue, and I think it has an economic imperative far more than it has an environmental concern behind it. Our region is not going to be able to remain competitive and attract the capital we need to make our innovative economy grow if we don't address this problem right now.
So you're talking about this as an economic investment and highlighting that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we need to be engaging. This isn't just something for government. The focus has been on government regulation, but it really doesn't matter if you can get a permit for something if you can't get an investor to put money into it and you can't get an insurer to back it. So we need to engage those communities as well as the environmental communities, local government, the regional agencies are working together. We've got four of us working together on climate change, the state agencies. All of us need to be looking at this from the individual level on up to the institutional level.
Let me bring our listeners into this and once again offer the phone lines to you. If you'd like to join the program, you're cordially invited to do that. Your questions and comments are welcome, and you can do that now. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. Again, we welcome your phone calls and the number to call. Toll-free, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or post a question or comment on our website simply by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment, as we talk about adapting to climate change here in the Bay Area. And in what ways, Laura Tam, is the Bay Area unique when it comes to climate change? Because there are some distinctive features about the Bay Area and climate change that we ought to highlight.
That's true. Climate change in the Bay Area, we're especially vulnerable to two critical impacts of climate change. One is, paradoxically, we're much more vulnerable to heat emergencies and prolonged heat waves than other parts of the state, which are more prepared and expect to have hotter weather for longer periods. Very few people in the Bay Area have access to air conditioning. And, you know, we don't have a lot of warm weather here in San Francisco. So the fact that we will be going from about 12 days of really hot weather in San Francisco each year to between, you know, 70 and 90 days of extreme hot weather is a fundamental change to our entire climate and what we expect, what we experience here on a daily basis. And of course, those impacts will affect people who are, you know, poor or elderly or very young children, people who are more vulnerable to extreme weather more seriously.
And forgive me, speaking about vulnerability, but there's more vulnerability, according to the Spur report, in certain communities in the South Bay.
That's true. So then our second major vulnerability is to sea level rise. And there are parts of the region that have subsided due to taking out groundwater and other things below sea level already. So there's parts of the South Bay that are 13 feet below sea level today, and there are parts of the Bay Delta that are 25 feet below sea level today. So those areas may experience sea level rise much more quickly or sooner, and perhaps with greater intensity.
And getting back for a moment with you, Will Travis, before we go to our callers to economics, another thing that's highlighted in the Spur report that I think particularly needs to be brought out for the public are the dangers, and this gets to economics specifically, the effects on the ecosystem. Certainly we recognize environmentally, but the effects on transportation, on public health, on energy are pretty substantial, to put it mildly.
Yes, they are. Yes, they are. If you think about the Bay, it is really ringed by transportation infrastructure. We've got freeways, we've got railroads, we've got BART, we've got airports, we've got ports all around the shoreline of the Bay. And that transportation infrastructure is the lifeblood of what makes our economy work. We need that mobility. So we're going to have to be retrofitting those facilities to make sure that they don't go underwater. Now, interestingly, that does provide an opportunity, because as we retrofit the transportation facilities, we can design them, and this is what the Spur report is talking about, of adaptation. You adapt the transportation infrastructure so that it can become part of the shoreline protection system, so that you, in essence, will get a freeway that is also providing the levee for protecting the low-lying areas behind it. So we have to start thinking about this in a more systematic fashion.
Let me bring our callers in, and we'll go first to Carter. You're on. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you. There is a perhaps a way to approach this. There are a number of ways, but one of them is solar on roadways, meaning that solar on the shoulders of roads and median strips of roads. This is a situation where taxpayers have already paid for a major infrastructure, and if we add solar photovoltaic materials to that infrastructure, we come up with a way to put thousands of people to work. We come up with a very, very inexpensive way of approaching clean, safe energy for everybody, not just those that can afford it. If we saturate the sun states in the United States, there are working models out there right now. Even SMUD has a something going on up in Sacramento. There's Portland has done something, and four different countries in the world are going this way, but it is very, very efficient, extremely cost-effective, puts thousands of people to work, and will build out the energy grid. You can go right from the roadways into the grid, so you're not pumping energy in expensively from the desert.
Laura Tam, let's get some response to you, and maybe talk in general about alternative energy like solar and how that plays into this SPUR report.
Yeah, renewable energy is really important. It's really important for us to transition to more renewables in our energy mix in order to, you know, wean ourselves from greenhouse gas producing energy sources. And that's a really interesting idea. It's that kind of innovative strategy that is the kind of thing that we need to start trying now as we try to meet ever more aggressive renewable energy goals across the state. And there are the utilities in the region and agencies that procure energy are really need that kind of idea, an innovative idea to try to think about how to really ramp up the amount of renewable energy that we're generating, because it's not enough today and we need to do more tomorrow.
Want to add some thoughts here, Will Travis?
Yes, I think Carter has a wonderful idea, but let's assume that that is successful beyond our wildest dreams. And let's also assume that right now, today, everywhere on the face of the earth, we park all of the cars, we shut down all of the coal-fired power plants, and we turn off all the lights. In other words,
we're still in trouble.
We are still in trouble. The SPUR report highlights we need adaptation not to deal with the emissions that we're producing now, but we're really dealing with the impact of the emissions that we put into the air a decade ago. And even if we are successful beyond our wildest dreams, we are going to have to adapt. So it is a two-pronged approach. Mark Hertzgart, who wrote a fabulous book called Hot, describes
it. We talked about on air with him.
The dilemma is what we're trying to do is avoid the unmanageable and manage the unavoidable, and we need to do both.
And I should mention that the interview we did with Mark Hertzgart, of course, is available in our archives, and we'll go to more of your calls, and we'll go to Petaluma. David, you're on the air. Good morning.
Thank you, Mike, for taking my call. I have a question about what seems to be a shift in the conversation about climate change. This program and your experts are really focusing on adapting to the inevitable climate change. And that, it seems to me, is really, as I say, a shift away from fretting about whether or not climate change is happening. Is this something, this shift, something that's happening in California, or is it something that's really happening globally?
Yeah, Laura,
I'll take my answer off the air.
All right, glad to have you take it off the air. It is global, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a great question. And yes, it's something that is happening all around the country. And actually, what's interesting is that it's something that's happening at the local level, because adaptation, because vulnerabilities to climate impacts are very different depending on whether you're on the coast or whether you're in a place that suffers from droughts or whether you're in a place that suffers from wildfires. Adaptation strategies need to be different depending on what the impacts are going to be to your region. So cities around the country are looking at adaptation now as a second front in the project to try to stop and solve and plan ahead for climate change.
Well, Travis, here's a listener named Matt who writes, recent USGS studies from the East Coast, Gulf Coast, and now the San Francisco Bay are showing clearly that one of the only actions we as a society can do to address sea level rise is to restore natural sediment transport on our rivers and streams to provide the suspended sediment needed to allow coastal wetlands to grow with sea level rise. Dam removal is one of the only options identified that will restore this critical sediment. Transport to our wetlands. Billions of dollars of wetlands restoration projects in the San Francisco Bay are at risk of being submerged due to sea level rise. Obsolete dams like Stanford University's Searsville Dam are trapping sediment needed in the bay, and removing this and other dams is our best hope for preserving the bay's wetlands. Get a comment from you.
Well, he's right. We do need to continue to have sediment coming into the bay system. Wetlands, tidal wetlands in particular, are about as close to magic as you're ever going to get when you deal with sea level rise, because all wetlands are wonderful for flood control. They soak up flood water and they absorb wave energy. So the wider the wetland in the front, the lower the levee can be in the back. Tidal wetlands do something else. They actually take carbon out of the atmosphere and put it into the ground. They sequester carbon. So tidal wetlands both are something we can use to reduce greenhouse gases and something we can use to adapt to those impacts of sea level rise. That said, the wetlands are just as in danger of flooding and being inundated as is downtown San Francisco. But if there is enough sediment in the system and the wetlands in themselves, as they're growing, the organic material decays and it can stay up with sea level rise to a degree. And after that, we're going to have to be protecting the wetlands just as we protect developed areas.
And on we go to more of your calls. We're joined now by Ben. Ben, welcome to the program.
Thank you for taking my call. My question is, how do we expect to get our government, businesses, and also the public to use more public transportation as a means to reduce greenhouse gas, when companies like BART are raising their rates and Caltrain is reducing services?
Laura Tam.
Well, transit is something that SPUR has been working on for a long time, and transit sustainability is something that is essential to supporting the growth and development goals of our region. We've been working for a really long time on trying to promote transit and to try to make that transit work for more people in more places. Certainly right now, there are significant fiscal challenges for a number of transit agencies, but I think that over the long run, people are working on strategies to try to make those agencies fiscally stable so that in the long term, we will have thriving public transit throughout the region.
And I thank the caller and move right along to another caller. Mike, you're on. Good morning.
Yeah, hi. Thank you. I kind of came into the program midpoint, so I apologize, but I wanted to preface my question by first saying that I fervently believe that the debate regarding climate change is over and that mankind is largely responsible for a lot of what's going on. But having said that, last summer in the Bay Area, I heard news reports that said it was the coolest summer in 40 years. And I was wondering if there was any clear explanation for what seems like an anomaly, really, if anybody knows the answer.
Well, you know, we've talked to climatologists, and they explain this in kind of mind-boggling scientific detail, how you can get really cold when you're moving toward heat. But can you give us a thumbnail sketch, Laura Tam?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of variability each year. And year to year, we have El Niños and La Niña effects in the ocean that affect our weather and the temperatures that we see in any one season. But overall, a cool year last year does not change the fact that the last 10 years have been the hottest 10 years on record, and we are seeing numerous climate impacts all over the globe, from severe flooding in Pakistan and in the Southwest this year and in Australia to extreme fires and extreme heat in Russia last summer that killed more than 10,000 people. I think that even though there are definitely seasonal fluctuations that affect the weather in any one place, and we got an enormous amount of snow on the East Coast this year, that does not take away from the fact that there's an overall warming trend.
And I thank Mike for the call, and we'll go to another caller from Mountain View. Bob, you're on. Good morning.
Hi. I was just wondering what the projections are for plug-in hybrids, the new technology coming in next year, not just hybrids, but and that being played out 20 years from now with the cost coming down combined with scientist Russell George's research that has been on All Things Considered, where he is seeded with metal shavings, a projection for, he's done a small project on a small scale, vast areas of the desert areas of the ocean, where it's desert, and having effect on CO2, just like the plant growth on sea wrecks and on pilings, but doing it on just shavings in vast areas of the ocean. His name's Russell George. The combination of just, and it's a very low-tech, very low-cost technology, done on it's a very simple thing. The combination of just those two technologies. So what you said earlier, that if we just stopped everything with all automobiles, it wouldn't be enough. But the other technology about Russell George, I don't know if you've heard of that, in combination with just what's coming online with hybrids.
Yeah, there's a lot of hope attached to hybrids. Will Travis, you made the remark about, you know, we're in trouble regardless of how we accelerate and what kind of cars we're accelerating, pressing down in terms of our foot on the pedal. You want to just respond to what the caller's bringing up here?
Well, there's a lot of geoengineering ideas. I'm skeptical of them because it's like doing an experiment in which we're all in the test tube, and I hope it works, but if it doesn't, it's not good for us. On hybrids, I think we should recognize here in the Bay Area, again, we have a wonderful opportunity. We mentioned why we are going to have a problem with heat days in San Francisco, partly because we're wusses. We're not used to heat. We have a wonderful, naturally air-conditioned climate here in the Bay Area, and we should take advantage of that. It takes about a tenth amount of energy to heat and cool a house in the Bay Area than it does out in the Central Valley. But yet we are building at the far extremes of our region where we have to then drive to get there. So if you look at two choices, one is you have somebody who lives in Palo Alto and works in Mountain View and they drive an SUV, and the other is somebody who lives in Tracy and works in Mountain View and they drive a the greatest hybrid there is. The person who lives close to work is going to be emitting less greenhouse gases. So the biggest opportunity we have is how our region grows in the future. And then public transit becomes easier to support because it's going to be running for shorter distances more frequently. And in a lot of cases, we don't even have to use it. We can walk, we can bicycle.
It's what we used to call smart planning.
It's the same thing. It's still smart. It's getting smarter all the time.
And let me ask you, if I may, Laura Tam, about what the greatest concern, if there is a kind of triage here or a way of hierarchical status given to what you highlight in the report. That is, we've got higher temperatures and heat waves on the one hand, we've got water uncertainty on the other hand, and we've got sea level rise. How does that rank, or does it?
Well, I think for our region, in the short term, the heat waves and growing sea level rise are probably the biggest issues that we're going to have to confront. Water uncertainty is something that we will certainly have to deal with. The Sierra snowpack could be as little as 20% of what it is today by the end of this century. But we have a little bit of time to plan for that. And in the meantime, we have to start thinking ahead for heat emergencies and sea level rise, because those are areas in which those climate impacts could begin to hit us very, very soon. Already we're seeing peaks, winter high tides that are as high as we're expecting tomorrow's sea level rise to be every day, and those flood transit corridors and other areas.
And again, people can read the SPUR report and all the 30 strategies that are recommended. A lot of work has gone into this just by going to spur.org.
Yeah? That's correct. And I also want to add that we're going to be having an exhibit in our building, the Urban Center, that will be really visual and help people learn more about what these threats are and what
that
we can do about them. It opens on May 18th.
And the building is where?
We're on Mission Street near New Montgomery, 654 Mission. And it's open to the public.
And we'll open another line of the public. Art, that's you. Hi, you're on.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. You mentioned about being heavy on the metal with driving. The speed limit at this time is 65 miles per hour in California. Most people are driving at 75. Here's the concept. Why not just lower the speed limit to 55 miles per hour? I can't understand why we can't do that, or is there any sense in bringing that up?
Well, there's sense in it, and it's brought up all the time. Will Travis?
Well, as I've said before, even if we did that and everything else, we still have to deal with adaptation. We all have a natural tendency, you know, if I can just find one thing that I can do, then I can ignore all the rest. And the challenge for us here is we are going to have more extreme heat days. We're going to have both flooding and droughts. We're going to have energy brownouts because of higher heat days. We're going to have worse air quality. And as we try to choose which one to deal with, it's whichever one we give lowest priority is going to pop to the top as the one that is the most critical concern. So all of these ideas for reducing greenhouse gases are extremely important, and we should be pursuing all of them. But even if we are successful beyond anybody's dreams, we are still going to have to adapt. And I think that is the point that the SPUR report is making.
And the SPUR report, well, we'll go back to you, Laura Tam.
Yeah, that's right. I just want to make one comment on that, which is if we don't start planning ahead for these impacts, then we will be in the position of having to respond to them as emergencies as they come up. And emergencies are not only more costly, but they also generally entail more suffering. So if we can plan ahead, then we can save ourselves some money and make it easier on people in the region.
It's much better to be preventive than to be reactive, or to plan ahead as much as one is capable doing, but we're talking about some serious kind of implementation here, aren't we?
Yeah, exactly. That's true. I mean, we need to start planning now, but we need to be implementing many of these strategies over the next 20 to 30 years.
Are you hopeful?
I actually am hopeful. This is a region that is known for innovation, if nothing else, and also for our beautiful environment that we have successfully protected for so long. Our region is going to grow, and I think that people here, maybe some of the people This area may come up with some of the adaptation solutions that the entire world could use.
Well, congratulations on the report. As I said, it's yeoman or yeoperson work. A lot went into it. And again, it's available online, spur.org. The exhibit, again, is when and where?
It opens on May 18th at the Urban Center and will be available until towards the end of July.
And thank you, Laura Tam, for being with us.
Thank you.
Sustainable Development Policy Director for SPUR. They're the San Francisco Planning and Urban Research Association. She's the lead writer on that report. Will Travis, thank you for being with us.
Good being with you again, Michael.
Will Travis is Executive Director of the San Francisco Bay Conservation and Development Commission, and that's the state agency responsible for protecting San Francisco Bay. He's also on the board of SPUR and chaired the task force that helped prepare the report that we've been talking about. Thanks to you, our listeners. We wouldn't be here without you, and appreciate your listenership. We're here with you every Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Another hour of Forum Up Ahead with Francine Prose, who's written a new novel called My New American Life. We'll talk with her about that. It's all about adapting to America, an Albanian immigrant. Thanks for being with us. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.